Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, with a new partnership, find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the reopening of Fresno's Fulton Street. After 53 years as a pedestrian-only mall, will the $22 million project finally be the catalyst to revitalize downtown Fresno? We'll ask that question and find out about the big party that's planned to celebrate the occasion this weekend. Plus, we'll find out how the historic Sugar Pine Railroad near Yosemite is recovering after a devastating wildfire struck the area earlier this year. Of course, when it comes to wildfire, all of our attention these days is focused on Northern California, where over 40 have died and thousands of buildings have been destroyed. Now, as residents there are beginning to return to what's left of their homes, many are beginning to file claims with their insurance companies. But as FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports, here in the mountains of eastern Madera County, many homeowners there say they're losing their insurance just at a time they could need it the most.
Frank Eland lives in an area near Coarse Gold in the foothills of eastern Madera County that insurance companies call a fire-prone zone. He says in the past 3 years, his homes have gone without insurance after being dropped by companies three times.
They don't look at the property, they look at their map, and they say no. On the other house, they never canceled it. But they did raise the rates from $700 a year to over $2,000 a year.
In response, he's fireproofed the couple acres he lives on, surrounded by dry grass and oak trees. He's mowed it down to the stubs, put gravel around his home, and used cement siding on his house instead of wood. He's even gone further than most people. That's him turning over his own personal fire truck. He's had to use it once to put out a fire on his neighbor's property.
Their fence was on fire. So I went down, banged on their door. The pump was not working, so they had no water. So I came home and got the fire truck, went down and put their fence fire out.
But he says that's still not enough to get affordable home insurance. Eland is just one of many in the area in a similar bind. In August, Bass Lake resident Teresa Wilson says her insurance dropped her three-story home after 22 years.
I've only had one claim in all of those years with my insurance company, and they wouldn't even talk to me, just the non-renew, and that was that. My insurance went from $1,400 a year to $3,200 a year.
The increases and the non-renewal notices stem from a few things. Brian Harper with Farmers Insurance in Oakhurst says his company predicted 5 years ago that the area would burn because of poor forest management and because of the effects of climate change, millions of dead trees and overgrown brush.
The insurance companies, not just farmers, but other insurance companies as well, had the foresight to say, something's changing. You know, we were in the middle of a drought. It seems to be that is the logical reason that they saw it coming. And then, of course, we have a bunch of fires that totally vindicates all the changes that they've made.
Harper says insurance companies have to assess how much risk they can take on. As a result, companies are either doing nothing, sending out non-renewal notices, raising premiums, or not taking on new clients. Another issue insurance companies are factoring in is that the Madera County Fire Department is short-staffed. Nancy Corprich doubles as the county's fire chief and the CAL FIRE unit chief for Madera, Mariposa, and Merced.
There's just not enough volunteers and there's not enough fire engines to meet the need in the underserved but populated areas of Madera County.
About half of Madera County's 17 fire stations have at least one full-time firefighter. The others rely on volunteer firefighters, and most of them only have one volunteer. The county also has a partnership with CAL FIRE that helps augment the shortage. But the crews with CAL FIRE are pulled across the state when fires spark, like they are currently.
If we had another large fire in Madera or Mariposa, our resources are going to be at minimal levels. We're down to not just our backups, but even what we would consider our next backups. One person on a fire engine is a dangerous situation.
And insurance companies don't see a station with one firefighter as a resource that can do much. Across the industry, companies have different formulas to calculate risk. This, combined with climate change and the health of the forests, raise that risk. The county tried to pass a measure earlier this year for a sales tax that would have used the funds collected to hire more full-time firefighters. It didn't pass. Janet Reese is a California representative with the Insurance Information Institute. She says insurance companies really do want to help people, but have to make sure they have enough funds to protect those they represent.
The main thing is that we want to be able to pay our claims. We want to rebuild. We want to help people recover. So we are anticipating how much we can each handle.
Reese says when a homeowner's insurance is dropped or premiums are raised, they should shop around with local agents and then online, because there are affordable options out there. She says it may take time to find one and to think of the process like shopping for auto insurance.
People don't think about that in a home. They tend to shop a lot for insurance on auto, but on a home, they sometimes don't think about, hey, I should go shopping. I should find out what else is out there.
For people like Frank Eland, who have shopped around and still can't find an affordable option, they're just going without insurance. He also doesn't have a mortgage.
I figure I can take care of it myself. Rolling the dice. I'm not worried about fire coming at me from the outside. My risk is fire from the inside by something going wrong here.
But for those who still have a mortgage and are having insurance issues, they'll have to take a higher premium, no matter the cost. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Earlier this year, we reported on a new immigration policy in Madera County. Whenever the county jail was releasing a foreign-born felon back into the community, it would coordinate that release with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, which could potentially detain or deport that felon. But when a civil rights group looked into the policy, it uncovered a problem, one that could amount to a violation of an open meetings law. It's something the city of Bakersfield may be facing as well. FM89's Kerry Klein reports on concerns over open government in the valley.
According to a press release written by the Madera County District Attorney, its new policy was enacted during a meeting of the County Board of Supervisors in March. It caught the attention of Angelica Salceda, an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. But when she combed through the minutes from that Board of Supervisors meeting, she found no record of the policy ever being discussed. But what was on the agenda was a closed session about a staff member, the director of the county jail, who's entangled in this new policy. Salceda submitted a Public Records Act request for more documents.
From the district attorney's press release, from other public documents that we were able to obtain, it was very clear that what the board did in closed session in a secret meeting was to adopt an entirely new policy for Madera County.
If true, this would be illegal. A violation of the Brown Act, a state law that regulates how local agencies make policy decisions. The foundation is that public policies should be enacted in public, not in closed session. Salceda and the ACLU sued.
It's incredibly disappointing that a legislative body that should be intimately familiar with the Brown Act requirements would violate those requirements, would do something in secret. They should well know that these types of policy discussions should be done in the public.
The case is ongoing. For its part, Madera County has flat out denied the allegations. County officials turned down an interview request but did issue a statement. It claimed the ACLU's allegation has no legal or factual merit and asserted that the closed session in question was rather routine. Concerns about the Brown Act have surfaced elsewhere in the valley as well. The Bakersfield Californian last week alleged that city officials there had broken the law by discussing tax policy during a closed session about litigation. The city has claimed no wrongdoing. Another accusation arose following a recall election of the Tulare Local Healthcare District's Board of Directors, though the district attorney there determined there had been no violation. However the Madera and Bakersfield cases are resolved, they still represent concerns about transparency in the valley's local governments.
Transparency of that sort is ultimately what allows the the people to hold their government accountable, which is really the linchpin for how our democratic system works. You can't hold the government accountable if you don't know what the government's doing.
David Snyder is executive director of the First Amendment Coalition, a nonprofit that advocates for government transparency. He says one purpose of the Brown Act is to facilitate public participation in local government, but it does allow for exceptions. Governing bodies can go into closed session to discuss things like personnel issues, pending litigation, or public security. But those exceptions are very narrowly defined. It can be illegal during a closed session to merely change the subject, much less adopt a whole new policy. Snyder says, from his understanding as an outsider, both the Madera and Bakersfield cases misused those exceptions.
Based on what we know now, there's a high likelihood that those legislative bodies didn't adhere to the Brown Act's requirements.
Because most Brown Act violations occur behind closed doors, Snyder guesses the law is actually violated relatively often, though accusations rarely result in litigation. And violations shouldn't happen by accident. State law requires elected officials to take an ethics training every 2 years, which includes Brown Act basics. Still, it can be easy to steer conversation into a legal gray area, which is why Susan Anderson says elected officials should be extra vigilant of the law. She sat on the Fresno County Board of Supervisors for 12 years before retiring in 2012.
Sometimes you're having a conversation about something and it just sort of leads, it's just natural, human nature, it just leads into a conversation about something else, or it reminds somebody of something else. So people had to be aware of it all the time.
That's why closed sessions typically happen with a lawyer present who can warn officials when they're veering into dangerous territory. Dan Cederborg is county counsel for Fresno, and he's sat in on dozens of closed session meetings trying to keep officials on the right side of the Brown Act.
It makes the actions of the board more cumbersome, but it's the state law. And that's how the public has decided they want their business done.
But when business appears to not have been done that way, there can be consequences. David Snyder says if the city of Bakersfield doesn't take corrective action, he and the First Amendment Coalition may sue city officials. The ACLU's lawsuit against Madera County will be taken up in its second hearing in November. It could still be months before the case is resolved. If the county loses, it'll be required to reimburse the ACLU's legal fees and open its immigration policy up for public discussion. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Valley Edition. The fountains are once again running in downtown Fresno. The city's public art collection has been restored, and for the first time in 53 years, yellow stripes on lanes of asphalt are back on a six-block stretch that was once the city's main street. This Saturday, the city and downtown property owners celebrate the reopening of Fulton Street with a party that contains the hopes and dreams of downtown boosters who for decades have been proclaiming the district's rebirth is around the corner. But will the removal of the old Fulton Mall and the introduction of vehicle traffic be enough to change the direction of a downtown that's been struggling since Richard Nixon was in office? Here to tell us more is Craig Sharton, the interim CEO of the Downtown Fresno Partnership, which represents downtown property owners. Craig, welcome.
Good to see you, Joe.
And good to see you, Craig. So for people who are listening to us right now and have not been down on the former Fulton Mall in the last few weeks since some traffic has been reopened on the north and south ends, what would we see right now? This has been a $22 million project. What's the scene right now?
Well, what they see is two very narrow lanes of traffic so that it is slow moving. One in each direction, and we have parallel parking, which is very critical to support the retailers and restaurants and such that will line the street. And then we have super wide sidewalks. So on one side, they're 14 feet wide, which is abnormally large. But on the other side, they're 28 feet wide. I would say maybe the widest sidewalks I've ever seen in California. And that artwork and the fountains and as many of the mature trees as we could save are all on that wider sidewalk so that there's enough room to accommodate the art, the fountains, and pedestrians and outdoor dining.
It's almost, and I went down there a few weeks ago myself to take a stroll and see what has already been done and what still remains to be done. And if you had left Fresno a few decades ago and came back and saw it today and saw the mall and the street, you might think, well, did they take all of it out or did they save? I thought that fountain used to be over there. Was everything removed or were some things saved? How did that work? Because a lot of it looks very similar, at least into the original design that it was before.
Yeah, we heard from the community. You know, we had a lot of public hearings about this and had thousands of comments and suggestions. And, you know, the art and the fountains and the design and the respect for the Fulton Mall were very high on the list. So that was, and that would have been high on my list anyway, but we really heard from the community that that mattered. And so that was all incorporated in. So 100% of the art was removed and restored and has been replaced. And it's just gorgeous. Almost all of the fountains, there were some really big, bulky fountains that had been turned into planters that hadn't even operated in for over 20 years as fountains. Those did not get replaced, but I don't think anyone would have argued that they were special in any way. They just filled in space, but all of the really beautiful fountains were built from the original blueprints, but with much better mechanics and filters and pumps so that they can operate much better. And they just came out really, I think, spectacularly. And then, you know, the designs of Garrett Ekbo's stripes in the mall have been rebuilt into the sidewalk. The coloring of the concrete is exactly the same as the color of the Fulton Mall when it first went in. So just a great attention to detail. And I think our goal was to have a high level of respect for the mall's design. And I think most people will agree that that we reached our goal.
Now, as a business and property owners organization, your goal is to stimulate business, stimulate activity. What's going to be the draw with this new Fulton Street project? Do you see it as being the amenities? I mean, this is maybe the most lavish streetscape of that I can think of in California as far as the art and the amount of money and detail, attention to detail with the fountains and the landscape. Is that going to be the draw, or is it commerce and the things that go along with that you see will actually bring people downtown? What's going to get the people out of their cars, out of other shopping areas, whether in Fresno or even beyond, to go downtown when they haven't in years?
Yeah, so as we see downtowns revitalized all over the country, they don't come back like they were. They come back in a new form. And it really, if I ask groups all over the time, so when you go to a city with a downtown that you like, what do you do there? And they always come up with the same list. I like to eat. I like to drink. I like to shop. I like to look at art. I like to listen to music. I like to people watch. I like to enjoy the old buildings. So, you know, whether you're in downtown Visalia or you're in Manhattan, you tend to do the similar kinds of activities when you're downtown. We like to be around a lot of other people. And so really creating a dining and entertainment district with our ground floor retail is our initial plan to get this started. They tend to be the ones that bring the foot traffic back. And they also change the hours of day. So, you know, office workers create a 9-to-5 downtown. And if you're going to have a downtown that has nightlife, you have to get businesses and restaurants and bars and music clubs, music venues to populate the street so that there's something for the customers to do besides just showing up for art and then getting back in their car and leaving.
Now, I was talking to somebody the other day who said they took a trip downtown to see the construction, to see what was already done. And they said they were a little disappointed because it was, in their words, the same old stores, the same old rundown buildings that were there before. The landscape was new, but other than that, not much had changed. Now, I know you have a lot of pop-up stores and special one-time-only things happening Saturday, but how do you respond to the person who says not much changed in reality?
Well, I'll give you a preview of my talk at the celebration that we're having on Saturday. Downtown revitalization begins the day the street opens. We're not done with it. This is the new starting point for it because now customers can get to the businesses. So now we can attract those businesses that need to have access and visibility from their customers. So this is what allows commerce to flow. And now we have to build the commerce, the restaurants and shops, et cetera, that are going to bring the customers down here. It can't happen in the other order. I mean, you have to go to extraordinary lengths to get people onto the pedestrian mall, I can tell you personally. But
yes, and you as a former Fulton right. Mall business owner that, yeah, that closed a couple of years ago.
Yeah, but, I mean, while we operated, we were successful only because we pounded the events and the publicity and the social media and went to extraordinary lengths to overcome the obstacle. And most businesses aren't going to do that. But we do have really fun things happening with some of our existing businesses. Are redoing their facades? And we have new restaurants that are coming in, and restaurants tend to be the first wave to get people to come out. So I think as we as a community say downtown is important, like it is everywhere else, and we go down and we shop at those stores like Root General Store or others. You go down to Los Panchos and try a cucumber and Fresno chili margarita. That's how downtown revitalization works. It ultimately is up to the community to have the downtown that we want. But it all starts this Saturday.
So I want to talk about the special things that are coming up this Saturday, though. You mentioned the existing businesses. I want to touch on that because that's been a concern of many. Do you see the businesses that have been downtown for many years, the Botanicas, the Tres Hermanos of the world, the clothing shops there that have been operating on the mall for many years, do they have a future in a revitalized Fulton Mall? How do they coexist with the new trendy types of shops that may cater to a different clientele? Can those two coexist?
They can, but ultimately, again, it will be up to the business owners and to the community how those changes occur. And there are always changes, whether the economy goes up or down, businesses either go up or down with it. And I saw this in Pleasanton. You know, when revitalization happened, some certainly the rents went up because there was more demand in the area. And some businesses adjusted their schedule to and their merchandise and took advantage of our marketing seminars and our merchandising seminars and our window display seminars and changed the way they operate to capture those new customers, which is their job. And some of them just said, no, I like closing at 6 o'clock. I don't care if there are a ton of people out here from 6 to 9 p.m. I'm not interested in doing that. And then they would close their doors. So, you know, it's incumbent on the businesses to look at who's walking up and down the street and find a way to sell them a meal or a product. Or, you know, I'm sure there'll be some that don't even open up for the grand opening when we have 10,000 people down there. And those are the businesses that are going to have the hard time.
Is revitalization just another word for gentrification or vice versa? And what can we learn from the other communities in California where gentrification has become a major flashpoint?
Well, it's a market economy. So what will exist is what people want. So if our community says, these are the businesses that are important to us, that is where I'm going to go put my disposable income, then those are the businesses we have. It is a direct reflection of what our community's true goals are, not just their stated goals. They can have the downtown they want by supporting the businesses that are important. And there's no other force in this. There is no government control. There's no shopping management company that decides what goes in or not. It is purely based on the community and whether the business finds a way to interact with their customers in a way that they can be successful.
Sort of the Adam Smith free hand of the market approach?
There's no other force. It is the free hand of the market. And you have property owners that would like to maximize their investment, which is their responsibility. You have business owners that want to be profitable, and you have a community that would like a vibrant downtown. And so how all those things take shape will be uniquely Fresno. And as a revitalization person myself, it will be fascinating to watch how this works. But just saying, save the stores and they don't change isn't going to work. You know, it's going to take more than just a cause. It has to be a dance, you know, that's going to come out in its own special Fresno fashion.
Not everyone is always fond of change. In fact, recently there have been some incidents of vandalism on the sections of the mall that have already of the street. I have to catch myself there, that have already reopened. Someone throwing paint on several occasions on the newly installed monument signs and wayfinding signs and light posts that have been put up there. Do you believe that that is an intentional act or just a random vandalism?
Well, what I believe and what's real might be two different things, but it does seem very intentional that they have only targeted the new things, like the wayfinding signs and the new monument signs and the new light poles. So it does seem like it's a little bit of a statement to me, but that's conjecture on my part. But I am glad that they're not targeting the art or the fountains or the other pieces. And so far it's latex paint, and we have one of the best groups inside City Hall is the graffiti team. I just hate to think what our city would look like without them. I called them on Saturday night. Peeve and I were out walking around and called them in and said, you know, there's some paint on a light pole that we missed. And 5 minutes later, they had pulled up and they were cleaning it up. So, you know, I think it's a reaction, but I don't know. I have yet to find any change that doesn't cause some reaction. And I can tell you, we have a plan that has worked in 175 other cities, and we're following a well-worn path. And I think the counter argument of keeping our downtown in the condition it was is pretty bizarre. So I can't really wrap my head around why someone would want to have it the way it was, as opposed to fixing it in a way that would allow it to function.
We're talking with Craig Sharton. He's the interim CEO of the Downtown Fresno Partnership, talking about the planned reopening, the grand reopening of Fulton Street taking place Saturday. There's all sorts of stages with live music and pop-up stores. We're going to talk about those in a minute. Craig, there's also a sentiment out there. Some people in local media have been quoted saying, you know, I have everything that I want in North Fresno, short of paying a parking ticket or going to jury duty. I have absolutely no reason or desire to go to downtown. From your perspective as someone who's a business booster, essentially, do you try to convince that person otherwise, or do you just move on to lower hanging fruit and trying to attract other customers?
Whether you're a downtown or you're developing a new product or service, you really need to have a target audience in mind.
So who is that for downtown? Is it that North Fresno person who hasn't been downtown in 30 years?
Probably not that person, but I can tell you that we do get a lot of North Fresno people downtown already, but it might not be that one. But really, downtown is the center of the Central Valley. So I am just as interested in providing a rich, urban, vital experience to people that live in Reedley or Hanford or Selma or Kerman as I am North Fresno. They're a part of our community, but they are a part of our community. The Central Valley really, to me, is, you know, focusing on Fresno, Madera, Kings, and Tulare primarily. The people within a 45-minute drive of our downtown that don't currently have a rich, you know, big city urban experience. And as we provide that, the whole Central Valley becomes a better place. So there are people that love downtowns. And there are people, if I said to a group of 100 people, you have a free trip to New York City, there'd be a bunch of them that would be ecstatic, and there would be people that say, I don't want to go. And so that's kind of how you divide up, you know, in the psychographic world. We want those people that are already there. If you go to Tioga Sequoia and look.
The beer garden.
The beer garden.
The south end of Fulton
Street. Yes, yes, thank you. The beer garden at Tioga Sequoia, and just looked around, you're going to see the people that are already here and already enjoying it. So it gives you a really good look. And it's not just young hipsters. I mean, there are a lot of baby boomers moving downtown. They love that rich city experience. It's not for convenience. I mean, we have high occupancy and high rents in all the downtown lofts because there are some of us that really do enjoy that. And, you know, for me, living in a gated community somewhere around strip malls would be horrifying. And I understand that there are people that wouldn't want to live in my neighborhood and probably aren't interested in downtown. So not trying to convince anyone, but I do think after we get the initial waves in of the most enthusiastic people, that other people will begin to follow as we get more business in there.
You represent property owners. What's happening with the big buildings? There's close to 1 million square feet of vacant office space in some of the most beautiful buildings in Central California, the Bank of Italy, the Helm Building, the JCPenney Building, the Guarantee Building. I can go on. The Mason Building.
The Gottschalk Building. Yeah,
beautiful.
No, there's a good list.
You know, this is above the second floor. Are there efforts underway to restore those buildings and to get more office tenants or other uses in those upper floors? Because every time someone goes down and sees the beautiful new street, they see a beautiful building that's also really kind of decrepit in some way, and that's sad.
Yeah, so if you think about rebuilding the economy of a place, which is really how it works, our tendency when I say San Francisco or New York is you immediately think of the big buildings. But what you actually do while you're there most often occurs in little buildings. The great pizza places in New York happen to be in small buildings between the skyscrapers, and the grills that you like in San Francisco are between the skyscrapers. So by focusing on the ground floor retail, mostly the 1 and 2 story buildings, and filling those with, we have 18 vacancies right now with restaurants or fun places to go, that generates the foot traffic. And as that foot traffic generation happens, then that can allow the people that need the investment or the loan to be able to fix up the bigger buildings will have a better time accomplishing that much larger task. Where it can cost $100,000 to renovate a little building, it can cost $20 million to do one of those big buildings. So the little buildings will generate more foot traffic. They provide that urban sidewalk feel that we like. And so it's a much straighter path to get those going. But we do have the owner of the JCPenney building, which has been working on this project for a long time, going into the city to get some of his final work done, and he has financing. And in that project, it would be 66 lofts, which would dramatically change the feeling of vitality on that corner. There are other buildings like the T.W. Patterson building that have been in regular operation and never closed, and the Pacific Southwest building, where they're now marketing for an operator for a rooftop restaurant now that they have their approvals for their second floor rooftop. So there are things that are happening. But again, the process is just starting.
And a lot of those smaller buildings are playing an integral part in this celebration you're having with all these pop-up stores. Tell us about some of the things that are happening on Saturday.
Yeah, so this is something that's been used successfully in other downtown revitalization efforts and have incorporated into our celebration. So we have the 18 vacant storefronts, so we've worked with a variety of either existing businesses or people that have an interest, everything from a artisan craft shop to a chocolate shop to a jazz bar with craft cocktails. The marketing genius Sam Hansen from the Grizzlies doing a ninja star throwing range. They're not actually metal ninja stars, but they'll actually have people showing you how to throw plastic ninja stars in one of the shops. And he's just been marketing all over the place. So when you walk downtown, I consider it like people stage a house. We're sort of staging revitalization so that people can see the goal that we are working toward.
You also have a lot of live music and entertainment. Where's that happening? What's going on there?
We have 3 stages, one at Mariposa, right by the clock tower, one on Kern Street, which is right by the outfield entrance to Chuck Chancey, And then we have an Arte Americas stage at Merced Street, which is right behind CVS. And so we've got, I think, 18, 20 local bands all playing throughout the night. We're going to have some more. We had so many bands, we're finding little pockets for them to play around, and some will be by the Warner's Theater. So the night will be filled with great local entertainment.
And you're going to have cruising on Fulton Street for the first time since 1964.
This is something I am really excited about. So we're kicking off the party after the ribbon cutting with 1964 and older cars that will be cruising, and then they'll be joined by later model cars. Fulton was the main drag. So they'd say drag in the main on Saturday night. And so we thought it'd be really fun to bring back a couple hundred of these old cars and really kind of give that American graffiti image that was downtown Fresno before the mall went in. And something that I think will appeal to a lot of ages, and should be some really great Instagramming and going on that night with some of the images of the old cars going down Fulton again. We've heard a lot of stories about people who met while they were dragging the main, or their parents met while they were dragging the main, or the one I love the most, you can't believe how many people must have turned 16 in 1965, because all I hear about is a bunch of people who said, they closed it the year before I turned 16, so I never got to drag the main, so I'm going to be there on Saturday night. And then after the cruise ends, we're pulling up the barricades, and you can come down and you can cruise Fulton on its very first night.
All right, Craig Sharton with the Downtown Fresno Partnership talking about the grand reopening of Fulton Street in downtown Fresno. We'll see what happens. A big change in store here, as for the first time in 53 years, the main street is about to reopen. Craig, what's the website if people want more info?
DowntownFresno.org, and go to our events, and you can either pull down the Fulton Street Party or Drag in the Main, or you can find Downtown Fresno Partnership on Facebook.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment. Thanks, Craig. We'll find out about a local road rally that's coming up to celebrate the life of a local artist and cyclist, and more. That's all coming up straight ahead on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The fires burning in Northern California have now grown to over 200,000 acres, destroyed or damaged 5,500 homes, and have killed more than 40 people. Closer to home, the area in the mountains of eastern Madera County near Yosemite is recovering from the railroad fire that threatened communities, resorts, and even a large grove of giant sequoias just last month. FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports from the historic Yosemite Mountain Sugar Pine Railroad on the recovery efforts.
Over!
Josh Treyer conducts train rides every couple hours along a four-mile route in the Sierra National Forest. It's all part of the Yosemite Mountain Sugar Pine Railroad. In late August, the fleet of trains and historic buildings almost went up in smoke.
As you guys can probably tell, we did have a little fire here a few weeks back.
On large portions of the ride, both sides of the forest and a little bit of the railway are charred. The wildfire started not too far away from the line. General Manager Shane Blackwell was on site that day, August 29th.
We were preparing to board for our second run of the day, a 12:30 run. Yeah, one of our employees had spotted a plume of smoke across the street from our entrance. We went into immediate action.
Blackwell then knew this historic property was at risk of burning, and his crew tried to put the fire out themselves.
We took the pump truck up, saw that it was out of our range, came back to the railroad, and by that time the fire was right on the highway's edge.
Blackwell and the rest of the staff were eventually evacuated. Fire crews moved onto the property to actively protect the railway on all sides. Blackwell says if it wasn't for crews choosing to stage here, the railroad would have been lost.
The fire went right around us. Even on our main line of track, there's only a portion of it that is affected by this fire, and I think it's again a tribute to those men trying to preserve this piece of history.
The company's operated here since 1965 at the site of the old Madera Sugar Pine Railroad, which operated from 1899 through 1931. The train was used to carry lumber that was logged here. Today, the company operates two historic geared steam locomotives called shays, which run off pressurized steam and fuel oil. Because there weren't enough tourists today to fill the 200-person train, we're riding what's called a Jenny rail car that can go about 20 miles per hour. It's a Ford Model A automobile converted for rail that kind of looks like a small version of a San Francisco cable car.
They were taxis, you could say, transporting men to and from mill sites to work sites, rather than firing a steam locomotive, which is quite labor-intensive.
Now, a month later, Blackwell says the railroad is still feeling the effects of the fire. Parts of the forest around the line are charred, and he says the company lost revenue because of the blaze.
We did lose a substantial amount of business. We missed one of our busier weekends, Labor Day weekend in September. We're just happy that it didn't stop our season. We were able to get one more little go before we shut down for winter.
But for the other riders and I, the fire damage is adding to the experience. As we head back to the station, Blackwell points out an area scorched by fire.
This wasn't a purposeful burn here. This was just something they were trying to maintain.
For visitors who weren't able to make it up because of the closure, the railroad will be open through October and maybe into November if weather permits. Taking a ride on the Yosemite Mountain Sugar Pine Railroad, I'm Ezra David Romero with Valley Public Radio News.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Many people across Central California know the name Ed Lund. Ed was a gifted artist, an instructor at Fresno State, and also an avid cyclist. He was killed tragically in a bicycle accident in a road rally a couple of years ago. Now, this weekend in Fryant, there's a road rally here dedicated to his memory and to raising scholarship funds for Fresno State students. It also features one of the world's premier cyclists, Levi Leipheimer. Here to tell us more about the event, we have Ed's sister, Elisa Lund Brown, joining us, as well as Mark Kranchek with the Edward Lund Foundation. Thanks and welcome to both of you. Elisa, I want to start with you and talk about your brother. Who was your brother? Tell us about why he was so important to so many in the Fresno area.
Ed, he reached everybody in every corner of the community. Even though he was came off as a pretty understated or calm guy, he had this energy that people were just drawn to. If you were in a room, he wasn't loud or boisterous. He was just the guy you were drawn to. And I think it's because he was truly authentic in the way he lived his life and projected to the community. He was a brilliant artist who put his creative time aside if he was needed by others, and he did that a lot. But he was also an avid cyclist. He grew up building his own bikes, riding his own bikes everywhere. He didn't get a driver's license until he was 18 because he thought he could do everything on a bike. And I think it was girls that finally woke him up to the joy of a car, but it was a vital part of Eddie's life since childhood.
Ed was a very integral part of two very tight-knit communities in Central California, the arts community and also the cycling community. Mark, how did this idea to hold a rally come about after his passing back in 2015?
Well, really, it came about with Lisa and her husband Buddy, and sort of all the supporters and family and friends he had in the area. And I don't want to speak on behalf of Lisa, but you know, I think there was this desire to offer something back to the community that Eddie touched and the people that cared about him so much. So they actually approached me and said, we're putting on this event, and I'm helping out. And it's been incredible, the support in the community that we've seen to date. It seems like me entering into Fresno and talking to people, and we put together a small video, the intensity with which people speak about Eddie and how he impacted their lives is truly incredible. So, ultimately he started as something just to almost a gift to the community. And then the support that's right behind it is incredible.
So you have some world-class cyclists taking part in this, including a name that may be familiar to some even casual observers of the cycling world, and that's Levi Leipheimer. He's taking part in this event, and there's an important tie there to Ed as well.
Yes. Eddie passed away during Levi's Gran Fondo in Sonoma in 2015. And at the time, it was really obviously tough, but Levi and the people at Bike Monkey who produced the race were there and supportive. And since that time, they've become really family to us and our family. And they've been a big part of helping us promote this and being supportive of it. When Levi heard about the memorial ride that the locals put on right after Eddie died, he came down and he rode quietly. You know, there was no announcement. He just rode alongside the community. And then the next year, Buddy and I went to the Gran Fondo because I needed to see and feel what that was that Eddie was so excited about and what he felt that day. That last day of his life, and I needed to get it to know what that feeling was. And we kind of went there quietly. We didn't announce ourselves either, but Levi heard we were there, and he found us, and we talked, and we hugged, and we cried a bit, and it was really beautiful. You know, he's a good man with a big heart, and Eddie would have liked him a lot. I think they would have been great friends. And so having him there as a presence and as just a good person is it's been really special and important.
So Mark, turning back to you, how does this event that's taking place in Fryant on the 21st work? What type of road rally is this? Where are they riding, and what can people expect?
Well, it begins at Millerton Lake. And it's really three courses that riders can select based on their ability and their preferences. There's an easy route, it's approximately 26 miles. There's a medium route, and then finally, one that's affectionately called the Hammer, as Eddie was known as the Hammer, due to the intensity with which he rode, and that's 102 miles. Being a road rally, there are time segments within the ride, so you can take your time at certain parts, but the time segments are really where you can set your personal record, your personal best, and we're going to give warning prizes to the winners for those time segments.
Was this an area that Ed liked to ride?
Oh, it's just, so Eddie and I grew up riding and hiking and driving when we were little through that area, through those roads and those mountains. And as Ed got older, he got very competitive with himself and those roads. And he was very passionate about the experience, not just for himself, but others. And he introduced a lot of new and burgeoning cyclists to the roads and the gravel and the hills and the climbs. He'd ridden bicycles all over the world. And this was probably his favorite area to ride in. So, yeah, it was special.
So now this event also is a fundraiser for Fresno State art students, raising money for them and their studies through scholarships. Tell me about that.
So Ed and I literally grew up at Fresno State. Our father was a professor of art there for 33 years. Ed spent his childhood hanging out with dad and all the professors in the art department there. And so when we started this foundation, it was with the intent of giving scholarships to students that Ed would have mentored and admired. These are students of need, And it's for scholarships for travel abroad, study abroad, because Ed was an adventurer, a traveler, and understanding other cultures was important to him, especially in his art. And that's what he brought to teaching at the university as well. So we have scholarships. Last year we gave 3 scholarships, changed 3 lives. This year we're going to change 4 more lives. It's something that I know Ed would be proud of, and these are students that he would have embraced, and it's really exciting to be able to give this back to the community and to these kids and keep that spirit of Ed alive.
Lisa, if people want more information about this event, where can they go?
We're on Facebook under the Hammer Road Rally. They can go to the lundfoundation.org. And all our events are on there, and they can register, they can volunteer. We have a festival that's open to the whole community, free to families, which will be fun. There's music, food, drinks, activities. There's a kids' ride. So there's probably the Lund Foundation website's the best place to go for that, but hammerroadrally.com is another avenue to get there.
Again, we've been talking about the Hammer Road Rally taking place Saturday in Friant. It is in memory of the late Fresno artist and cyclist Ed Lund. It's going to be featuring one of the world's greatest cyclists presently, Levi Leipheimer. Ed was riding in Levi's event in 2015 in Sonoma when he lost his life in a tragic accident. A man who was close to many in the art and cycling community, and his legacy lives on. Talking today with his sister, Lisa Lund Brown, as well as Mark Krancheck of the Ed Lund Foundation. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org. You can also tweet us at KVPR and at Valley Edition. And you can find our podcast and audio archives on our website online at kvpr.org. Subscribe to the Outdoorsy podcast, the Valley Edition podcast. And you can also download our new app, our KVPR app, on the iTunes Store and Google Play for your mobile device. Check that out online and take KVPR with you wherever you go. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess, Carrie Klein, and Laura Tsutsui, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager John Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This has been Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. The California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, with a new partnership. Find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.